A major gathering is set to kick off this week in the Russian city of Sochi, and it could have significant global implications. That's one of the key international stories in the coming days, and with me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, let's start in Sochi. Who's invited to this get-together?
Well, yes, Mark, this is a major conference. As things stand, 47 African heads of state have confirmed their participation in this event, which is being co-chaired by President Vladimir Putin, but also the leader of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is also head of the African Union. But this is really about Russia rubbing hands together, shaking hands with African heads of state. So Russian influence in Africa is what this is really all about. And over the past few years, Russia has re-emerged as a force to be reckoned with on the African continent. And of course, your older listeners will remember that Africa was once, in living memory, carved up to some extent by the United States and the USSR during the Cold War. So Guinea, for example, in West Africa, a small country, was known as the Cuba of Africa because it was seen as a Soviet communist satellite state. Well, things changed a lot when the USSR collapsed, as my colleague from BBC Africa, himself from Southern Africa, Nick Erickson, explains.
Up until that point, decades upon decades of close Russian alignment and involvement with the African continent, using the continent, I guess, as a proxy for its war against the United States, its Cold War against the United States. With the fall of the Soviet Union, that ended abruptly, but Russia has been slowly trying to creep back.
Well, Rob, does it look as though we're heading back to those Cold War days?
Well, it's possible. Russia is certainly asserting itself across the globe. You only have to think of its annexation of Crimea, for example, and its influence in the Syrian war. Remember, the big power in Africa in recent years is China. It's made huge investment in African countries, much of it part of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative. Russia does not want China or other international players like the US to dominate the continent of Africa. So that explains why last year Russia's trade with African countries reached $20.4 billion. That is four times more than it was in 2010. And Moscow has seen a growing number of official visits by African heads of state to Moscow. There have been 12 in the past 4 years. So you can see there's more Russian involvement in the past few years. There's a kind of gradient heading upwards of Russian involvement in Africa. In terms of how they're involved, well, arms exports are a big piece of it. So last year, Africa accounted for a third of Russian arms sales, with Egypt and Algeria topping the list. There's Africa's mineral wealth, of course, so Russia's keeping a close eye on that. But also major efforts by Russia to invest in energy infrastructure in Africa. So it's been reported, for instance, that Mr. Putin will discuss the construction by Russia of Egypt's first nuclear power plant, with Russia offering Egypt a $25 billion loan for that. So all of this comes together with this big summit this week, 47 African countries hosted by Vladimir Putin. This is all about the Russian game for Africa, Russian influence in Africa.
All right, Rob. So let's move to Asia now, looking ahead this week to a landmark event in Taiwan. What's that about?
Yes, well, this coming Saturday, Mark, we'll see many thousands of LGBT people gathering in Taiwan's capital, Taipei. It's being billed as Asia's biggest pride march, complete with colorful costumes, elaborate floats, and everything else you would expect. But the context is interesting because earlier this year, Taiwan became the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. I should say that was controversial. Taiwan is quite a conservative country, so there are no shortage of people there angered by the same-sex marriage vote back in May, the Pride March this week, and so on. Indeed, 2 years ago, when Taiwan's constitutional court ruled that same-sex couples had the right to legally marry, there was a public backlash. That pressured the government there into holding a series of referendums, and those referendum results showed that a majority of voters in Taiwan rejected legalizing same-sex marriage, saying the definition of marriage should be the union of a man and a woman. So, Taiwan said it would not alter its existing definition of marriage in civil law, and instead would enact a so-called special law for same-sex marriage. So you can see that this big gathering this week and the context in which it comes is a major, major issue for Taiwan and for Asia.
All right, Rob, finally, on Friday, that is the last day for visitors to climb an Australian landmark. What is that?
Yes, well, it's one of the iconic images of Australia, the giant red sandstone rock, formerly known as Eyre's Rock, now called Uluru. It's situated bang in the middle of Australia, sits on a desert plain, is oval in shape, and reaches a height of some 2,800 feet above sea level. It measures 2.2 miles long by 1.5 miles wide, so it's a great huge red rock bang in the middle of Australia. But though it's so remote, it's a huge tourist attraction. But back in the 1980s, ownership of the rock was returned to the indigenous people of Australia, the Aborigines. They say the rock holds sacred significance for them and have long lobbied for it to be shut to tourists. And the Australian government agreed, and this coming Friday is the last day that visitors can show up and walk up the rock.
And it sounds like lots and lots and lots of people have been doing that.
Well, yes, the pictures are incredible, Mark, with hundreds of people walking up in a narrow queue. In fact, it looks a bit like a crowded city sidewalk at the moment. But all those people are the problem because indigenous groups say they leave trash on the mountain. They use the rock as a toilet. They even toss their used nappies or diapers there. And there are occasional accidents. Several people have slipped and fallen to their deaths. I should say the move to ban tourists has its critics. Some say the rock belongs to all Australians. Some even claim this is just a way for indigenous groups to control and therefore charge for people to climb the rock. So you can see this is a big issue that's kind of coming to a head this week in Australia.
All right, Rob, we'll look for your selfie climbing the rock before Friday on Twitter or Instagram. That's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.